Welcome back to season 4 of our podcast, The End of the Road, brought to you by the Wrangell Mountain Center and our supporters in Alaska and around the globe. We thank you. I'm your host, Sabrina Simon, Director of Operations for the Wrangell Mountain Center.
And I'm John Erdman, Executive Director of the Wrangell Mountain Center. We are a nonprofit organization dedicated to connecting people with wildlands through art, science, and education in Alaska.
We invite you on a journey through our series featuring hand-picked stories and poems told by McCarthy locals and visitors throughout our 2023 summer programming, all expressing our unique experience of this thing called life. Thank you for joining us. This episode is called Of Grief and Loss. And for it, we picked stories and poems that intimately profess our individual relationships with grief and loss. Storytelling has always been an intrinsic part of processing grief. It allows us to recollect the memories of a loved one, to learn about the parts of ourselves that maybe we hadn't given much attention to. It allows us to build emotional connections with our listeners, who I believe will always see themselves in the story being shared. This episode is my personal favorite because I believe in the rich compost that grief provides. The nutrients for love, creativity, connection to the soul, and deep expression. First, we hear a poem by Colin Warren, a McCarthy local, who shared during one of our Word Jam events in the old hardware store. Here he is.
Hi guys, how's it going? All right. So I usually get to one of these just once a year. I don't know, too many projects, all that stuff. But last year I read the poem that I wrote for our dear friend Kyle that passed. And when I was gathering poems for this year, I thought about reading one for Jason. And I felt bad for a second because, you know, God isn't just burdening you guys with sadness. But then I remembered that, you know, happy poems usually kind of suck. So I went ahead with it. And before I start, this is a photo of Jason that Luke McKinney took and passed around. And I just want all you guys to see him a little bit as I read this. And if you guys don't know, Jason was killed just after his 38th birthday, the gunshot to the heart and killed him almost instantly. He had 1 second before he died. Excellent. Conspiracy theories around that. This is called String Around the Stars. There was zero doubt that his well was deep and splashed and chugged and played and swirled. And most importantly, gave out a resounding sense of purpose. How is it the silver-tongued dirtbag capitalist, student of humans, strummer of all, without a pick in his pocket he played? Songs about love, which would never leave him alone. Songs about graybeards and their wisdom. He was the man you're looking for, blues plastered across his face. Sorry. Without a pick in his pocket, he died, strumming, always strumming, as if no one was his fool. And we all know that except for that fateful day, he was always the one getting the deal. His words were eloquent, but they didn't remind you of silky footprints on a beach. His words were like a ballerina Sasquatch tearing ass through the tundra. He gave as good as he got and he knew it, but he needed you to know it also. He needed you to trust him. and you just try, Jack, to not trust those pleading brown eyes, forever burdened by eternal optimism. They held the same power as the moon over a frozen landscape, both serene and overwhelming at once. Where many men see vast emptiness, he saw the illuminated nutshell. And boy, did he share his vision. I don't think I'll ever get over not having another chance to see him sauntering in suspenders around his junkyard. Popping out from a heap suddenly, shit-eating grin like a boy holding a present. The exact thing I need, he had it. It surprises precisely no one that knew him that as a child he was the first one at the park to double, triple, quadruple the length of his kite string. Dear brother, how very naturally you connected us to the heavens.
Of Martine Prechtel, a renowned student and teacher of grief work. Grief expressed out loud, whether in or out of character, unchoreographed and honest, for someone we have lost, is in itself the greatest praise we could ever give them. Grief is praise because it is the natural way that love honors what it misses. A story about grief is always a story about love, and we heard that in Colin's voice that night in the old hardware store. We heard the immense love for his departed friend. Listening back again, I feel that if you could package up the sound of what it's like to truly praise someone's existence, it's the sound of Colin's voice that night. We all heard it and felt it. Colin, thank you for sharing that part of yourself with all of us. In this life, we are called to not only grieve the loss of loved ones, but the loss of our beloved landscapes as well. In our next poem, we hear about the complicated feelings of grief we are all now experiencing as a human race around the loss of the health of our planet. The term I learned and love to use for this unique and visceral emotion is called solastalgia. It was coined by philosopher Glenn Albrecht in 2003 and is a beautiful blend of Latin words. Solari meaning comfort, solus meaning devastation, and algia meaning pain and suffering. It describes the sense of feeling homesick, except for that the person who experiences this solastalgia hasn't left their home. Rather, it's our home who is leaving us. This is McCarthy local Jeremy Pataki in the old hardware store during the same evening at Word Jam.
I'm Jeremy Pataki. Thank you, WMC. The Word Jam is like one of the best things about this, one of the many good things, but one of the best things in this fine valley. I think I'll read two poems, kind of a newish one and then an older one. And I'll start with this poem, which is kind of for the Kennecott and Root glaciers, although the only glacier that I think is actually named in it is the Aklutna Glacier, which is out by Anchorage and the Chugach. It's the water source for the tap water in Anchorage and other places. Kind of a climate change poem written in kind of dialogue with this place. Glacier Requiem. Glacier, dressed in late 20th century finery, you were not snow white, but a bit ashen, a tad dirty. Dressed like a one-hit wonder singing Baby Don't Go tunes. I can hum the melody of your single, but will never remember the lyrics. I drank you, some from my hand, some from my flask that also works with whiskey from the city, distilled with water from the lake that catches all that a Klutna glacier melts, catches rain and undone snow as well, no doubt, catches stray reflections of golden eagles migrating, and hapless wild ice skaters sailing solo on its windswept ice. One flies clean into an open water trap, like a mosquito into a biker's open maw. There's no way back from those black holes. And there's no way to get you back, glacier. Those summers we'd step onto you from land up there. That year when we could see for once the ridge beyond from here. The new map with new lakes grown before you, like entire valleys freed up in the warm spells, fattening the creeks and rivers, sloughs and breaks, broaching the beachfront questions, questing from alpine vantages down to shorelines and attentive, pushy oceans. The confident seas seizing all the capes and surging up springtide sloppy streets, or fondling ships all chafing at their dock lines. You deserved a better afterlife, but you'll be waters staining carpets in the bedrooms of the poor plus indignant moneyed ones still soaking in the notion that is no notion but is proof, in fact, is proof that the shoreline as we thought we knew it shrunk. Glacier, I mistook you for a glacier primped for parties yet uncalendared. Party of one I am without you now that you departed. I'm planted by your grave of gravel in a valley growing brush, breath stopped by a throat lump plug of ice that I would melt if I could myself, if the world we made wasn't set to do that for me.
Sounds contradictory to say, but a part of what is so beautiful about living in the Wrangles, so close to enormous glaciers, is that we do have the opportunity to be in direct relationship with grief. And I say that this is a beautiful thing because just as it is our soul's right to love, it is our soul's right to grieve. These landscapes provide for us potent opportunity for us to engage in both love and grief. Thank you, Jeremy, for sharing your poem with us and allowing us to connect to that ineffable feeling of soul nostalgia. Next, I'd like to share my own experience of grief and loss. I shared this poem on the first night of our 3-day storytelling festival, which was hosted by Glacier View Campground on the west side. I was so nervous to share this because for a while, my grief was very personal to me, as I'm sure is the case for so many of us, especially when we live in a culture that is failing to create supportive space for grieving and to pass on the ritual of sharing in our grief collectively. This poem and story touches on a few layers of grief, from losing someone you love to grieving something you never had or a life that could have been, and also the grief of longing to belong, the lack of being able to undeniably know what home is.
This is a story called Barefoot and Pregnant, and it's kind of written like a poem, so I'll start. Someone once said, while degrading a hippie traditionalist Christian community in the Blue Ridge Mountains, they like their women to be barefoot and pregnant. And I thought, how nice. The image of a pregnant woman barefoot in the woods. Something about this image is so striking to me. It's so powerful. It's beautiful beyond words. There's something ancient about it, something like coming home to the hundreds of thousands of years of lineage that carried me through blood and who deposited me into the womb that birthed me. I was pregnant then with my son, Jude, and I wanted a barefoot home so badly. It's said that being barefoot connects a person more closely to the earth, and having never felt home anywhere in the world, I wanted that connection to a place. I wanted to feel home somewhere before I started my family, before I met the person my body would create. My feet have always felt that sense when they're planted on the earth, and I desperately tried to find the place that would make the rest of my body feel the same, that would make my spirit feel its worth. I thought, these people have really figured it out. They ground their feet in the soil beneath them and their spirits in the heavens above their hearts. So I packed my things and I got on a plane and I left that house that I had gotten stuck in, full of memories of anger and abuse, so bad that I couldn't leave my room. And I left the place where I'd hidden my bed waiting for my dad's episodes of rage to end, where my heart rate shot up just by hearing his thunderous footsteps coming up the stairs. And I knew that hiding in that small room, cringing every time I heard his loud voice from the hall, was hurting my body and therefore hurting my son, Jude. I got off the plane in Asheville and was picked up by a woman who brought me to their property full of rolling hills, and I joined this strange community for just under a week that summer. If I did have a better sense of where I belong, I imagine there might exist the kind of humidity I felt that week, or the kind of buzzing, chirping sounds that rise up from the tall grasses and rounded trees. Something that I miss being here. The women in this community rarely showed their skin, except, of course, for their feet. They took care of their children and the kitchen and never spoke over their husbands. The men were kind, but dared not to speak too much to me, a single pregnant woman, for their focus was on the Lord and on their families. They took care of the animals and the buildings and came back from a day's work expecting a homely meal and an inspiring prayer. And honestly, I was really attracted to their faith. I had never experienced something quite like it. I found myself being accepted into a community that was invested in my peace and my happiness. And although their behaviors and culture deeply challenged my identity as a feminist, I found myself asking the question over and over, could this be it? The closest thing I could call home at that time in my life was my horrific mental landscape, a product of being lost in hatred for the man that left me to face pregnancy alone. A hatred that boiled deeply within my bones. I discovered that hatred is a horrible ailment and an oppressive sickness, and I had heard that it could be alleviated through a deep sense of forgiveness. And although I had known little about the Bible or Christianity besides all the violence it has imposed, I knew that Jesus was like a whole nother thing and that he had a relationship with forgiveness for which most people have never known. So I attended their prayer times where they danced and sang and reflected on how they could be better humans, more faithful, more devoted, more giving, more kind. And I have to say, I felt something stirring within me that I hadn't felt for some time. I felt alive. I felt a glimpse of what it could feel like to be rid of the hurt and hatred I had to survive. A light was growing in my heart, one that promised an end to my suffering, one that promised a home for my son to be born into, and for our lives to really start. So, how was it then that not a week into my stay at this life-giving place, I was rushed to the hospital complaining of severe lower back pain? The first doctor told me, "You're fine. Jude's fine. It just so happens that his head is situated on your cervix, but nothing to worry about." The next emergency visit a day later, the doctor told me, "You're fine. Jude's fine. It just so happens that his head is situated on your cervix, but nothing to worry about." There was something to worry about, though. In fact, just moments after the doctor had assured me, because as the picture showed, Jude was face down and ready to come out just 20 weeks too early. And so I went into labor that day with a child I had barely gotten to know, but who I always remember swimming in my belly, already away from and annoyed by my pressing on him with love. I was surprised and then heartbroken by the time I got to hold him. He was already a full human being and bigger than I had expected, with all his fingers and toes. And the nurses remarked, "How handsome! He's so big for his age. What a beautiful face." And I looked at his tiny blue knit hat that he came out of those mysterious white rooms wearing, and I imagined how he would have towered over me by the time he was only 18, and how little space that tiny blue hat would have taken up in the palm of his hand. But I had to leave the hospital that day, on the phone with a funeral home, saying things I never imagined I would say. "Hi, hello, I need to arrange for my son to be cremated." I had to browse through a magazine of tiny urns made for babies when I found the one blue and silver with doves flying all over, and I burst into tears and said, "That's the one, let's go." I limped out of the hospital to the car on a bright and humid summer day, and ever since then, every moment has taken me further away from what it feels like to be a mother, from what it feels like to be growing a beloved son, and from what it feels like to be growing a home. I used to think I was so selfish and egotistical to expect an answer for our suffering, that it wasn't the universe's job to make us feel better or loved or secure or safe, that it's our delusion and our belief in the lies that we've been fed that say that we're separate, that this false belief was what makes us buckle and expect our gods to give us some resounding response. But I still find myself wanting an answer for that day that too quickly ended my opportunity to walk barefoot and pregnant in those ancient and healing mountains, that ended a life I had imagined as a tiny, perfect human running wild with wonderment through that abundant playground, the forest. I still call out to the universe, even to Jesus here and there, to ask what happened on that day and why, when I had to cover my bare feet with shoes and I had to lose my son, Jude. Thank you.
Honestly, it was kind of hard for me to listen back to that recording. It felt like grief was this wild thing that you could hear in my voice just underneath those words. And it reminds me of how difficult it is to hold grief, especially from others, because it's this wild, untamed thing. And it reminds me of a quote from Francis Weller. He says, "Grief is subversive, undermining the quiet agreement to behave and be in control of our emotions. It is an act of protest that declares our refusal to live numb and small. There is something feral about grief, something essentially outside the ordained and sanctioned behaviors of our culture. Because of that, grief is necessary to the vitality of the soul. Contrary to our fears, grief is suffused with life force. It is not a state of deadness or emotional flatness. Grief is alive, wild, untamed, and cannot be domesticated. It resists the demands to remain passive and still. We move in jangled, unsettled, and riotous ways when grief takes hold of us. It is truly an emotion that rises from the soul." Lastly, we hear from Katie Ederman, whose story expands on the life-altering experience of grief and loss, and how that can reshape your entire outlook on life. She shared her story during the second night of the storytelling festival in our old hardware store. And just for context, she references KWG, which is Kennecott Wilderness Guides. They're a local guiding company who she works for. Here's Katie.
Hello, everyone. I'm Katie. It's my first summer here. And last night I got to watch the first night of the Storytelling Festival. You guys really inspired me. So I wanted to show up tonight with a story. And I will give a little trigger warning. It's a bit dark with some, I don't know, physical injuries in it. So yeah, but it's one of the things that brought me here. Before I came here, I was working as an acrobat in Las Vegas. And as the summer days pass by, I can feel the layers of that experience slowly unravel. The thrill, the uniqueness, and the despair of nearly a decade in the circus world. I haven't yet been able to understand how, as a performer, I existed in a space that balanced such intuitive self-expression with pragmatic indifference. My main specialty was the Russian swing, a steel triangular frame with a 4 foot long by 2 foot wide platform where four people stand and catapult the front flyer into the air upwards of 50 feet, gifting them a few seconds of unencumbered flight before diving into a small pool below. I was the flyer standing at the front of this small platform with three 200 pound men behind me. The technique is to push the swing back, and at the moment of weightlessness, the flyer steps together, locks himself in a tight squat, hips forward, chest up, as the porters transfer their weight back, carry it through to the front of the swing. The flyer releases their hands, stands up, and explodes into the air. I have never felt anything like it, those moments where I just get to float, time stops, and I am free. In the extreme spaces that I move in between, I recognize that those moments do not come without a price, and how the frequency of being in a circuit of 10 shows a week, 52 weeks a year, bad days are unavoidable. It was in February 2020 that my first friend lost connection with the swing. Hands slipped, feet flew, and he sailed into the air before landing on the dry stage below, immediately unconscious. The show is stopped, curtain drawn. I found myself being helped out of the fetal position and ushered into our training room. Standard protocol when something goes wrong is we all gather to wait. A room full of 60 out-of-breath performers. A couple of clowns with their big shoes and silly makeup, now tainted with furrowed brows and silence. Costumes half on, musicians still holding their instruments, towels and robes, smeared makeup, and worried whispers. A stage manager comes in. The ambulance is on its way. Mostly in shock, she's new and doesn't know what to say. It's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. You can't say that when our friend is unconscious and we don't yet know if he's breathing. An announcement comes over the audience. We apologize for the interruption. The injured performer will make a full recovery. Not yet knowing whether that would be true, the musicians restart and the show goes on. When we bow, we are just feet from the audience. And I am not afraid to show myself. That night I let the tears fall and sobbed to our standing ovation of 2,000 people, not quite understanding how or why we keep going. So a year later, during training, when I saw another friend go from a strong flying stance to feet slipping and slamming into the stage, again, I was peeled out of the fetal position and taken away. It was during one of our mandatory practices. Her limp body lay white, seizing. There is rarely family in the world we exist in. We take care of one another. The way that I called her husband, a foreigner just beginning to acclimate to Vegas, I ordered him an Uber to the trauma center and raced after the ambulance that carried my friend. They kept her behind closed doors, no visitors, so we sat. And my phone rang. Stage management, making sure I'd still be back in time for first show. This piece still consumed me, how we just keep the machine moving without acknowledgement of what has occurred. And whether it was a desire to be amongst community or to distract myself, I returned to work and performed in both shows that evening. As she recovered, they hired another friend of ours to replace her, a beautiful, strong woman who I would also watch get ripped from the swing. Who I would also hold myself and start rocking for. For her, the show did not even stop. She had been peeled off beyond the view of the audience. This time, I skipped the training room and walked straight to PMed. Door closed. They ushered me in. She was physically fine, in shock, some miracle. The music continued, the characters played. After Russian swing, we have 10 minutes to change and be 60 feet high in a suspended grid for our next act. A stage manager rushed in and looked at our friend lying on the table wrapped in towels. Are you still good to high dive? Tears streaming down our faces. I am not a reactive person. I do not yell nor raise my voice, but in this moment, I lost it in hysterical laughter. How far can we be from one another and from ourselves to not step outside of the machine for just a moment? To not be grateful that our friend is still alive. So when I handed in my resignation this winter, shortly after accepting a summer job with KWG, I walked out of my artistic director's office with relief coursing through my body. In April, I took my final bow. My circus family held my final tapis rouge, where they thanked me for the usual things like passion and contribution to the show. But there was an emphasis on safety, on being vocal, on the way that I cared for the people around me. And I realize now what they were thanking me for. They thanked me for being human. In the weeks that followed, I packed my home into boxes, visited friends and family, filled my little green Tacoma with all the comforts she could hold, and began my drive north. Each mile, I felt the claws of the city slowly loosening their embrace, the hardness of my shell softening, arriving to Alaska for the first time, May 10th. Winding around these mountains, straight into this valley, my new home. It is not out of the ordinary to find myself missing performing, that form of self-expression and precision. There was one day in July in particular, I felt myself dancing, moving, trying to release that fluid energy that's pent up inside of me. I imagined what it might be like to step back into that theater this fall, knowing the door has been left open. That same evening, I received a different call. A different friend in emergency surgery, paralyzed. This time, I found myself in the fetal position in the back of the KWG van, rocking, holding myself, helpless and far, far away from a space where there is also nothing that I can do. I find myself trying to understand the juxtaposition between loving something so completely yet having so much resentment towards it. I often fought for safety, more contingency plans, better training. I realize now I was fighting for the layers on the surface, the pieces of the machine that were within our grasp to change, rather than pinpointing it for what it was, a lack of humanity. I didn't come here this summer because I believe the space to be more safe or less extreme. I see and I hear how this indifferent landscape has its own wild and wonderful stories to tell. What I do know is that I am someone who is pulled to dance with the line, to play and to explore. And I want to dance amongst an environment and a community that demands that we feel things, that we share things, that we move and behave and experience as we are, the good, the bad, the darkness, the light, to independently and collectively allow ourselves to simply be human. I feel so grateful to have found it here.
There are several layers of grief to touch on here in Katie's story. The grief in feeling a lack of humanity, the lack of security and safety, the lack of trust. But what I want to highlight is that I remember watching and listening to her that night. Her face lit up during parts of her story and grew somber during others. What I feel that her story represents is this unique ability to hold grief and appreciation together in harmony within your heart. Her story of grief birthed her into her story of joy in finding a home in McCarthy, of being among people who demand humanity, who demand that we feel things. That sentiment reminds me of a poem by Rosemary Wetola Tromer. So I participate in a weekly grief tending circle, and at the end of our first gathering, I felt this overwhelming feeling of joy. I wanted to share this joy with the group, but I was scared to because I didn't know how it would be received. There was so much pain and grief and sorrow and confusion and tenderness that I witnessed over the previous hour and a half in this group as we shared our reasons for being there. I thought the other participants might think it was strange that being with those emotions would inspire joy in me. But the truth was that my heart was cracked wide open and joy was pouring out. I hesitated for a while and ended up staying silent. But the facilitator closed with this poem, and to me, the synchronicity was undeniable. It's called For When People Ask. I want a word that means okay and not okay. More than that, a word that means devastated and stunned with joy. I want the word that says, I feel it all at once. The heart is not like a songbird singing only one note at a time, more like a Tuvan throat singer, able to sing both a drone and simultaneously two or three harmonics high above it. A sound, the Tuvan say, that gives the impression of wind swirling among rocks. The heart understands swirl, how the churning of opposite feelings weaves through us like an insistent breeze, leads us wordlessly deeper into ourselves, blesses us with paradox, so we might walk more openly into this world so rife with devastation, this world so ripe with joy. Thank you to all of our listeners for entering this vulnerable space with us today. And thank you to all the people who have deeply shared their most intimate parts with our community. We honor you. We honor your grief and your loss. Thank you for being with us throughout season 4, and we're excited to see you next winter when we bring you season 5. This podcast series was written and produced by myself, Sabrina Simon, with the help of John Erdman. Special thanks to our featured storytellers, our 2023 Storytelling Festival business supporters and sponsors, including McCarthy River Tours and the Roadside Potato. And a special thanks to Cole Pompey and Richard Atmo for contributing their original music.
You can go to www.wrangles.org, that's Wrangles with two L's, to listen to more episodes from our End of the Road podcast, or find us wherever you find your podcasts. At our website, you can also help support us financially. You can sign up for our monthly e-newsletter, and you can check out the programs that we operate here in McCarthy during the summer. And thank you for joining us at the end of the road.